Hey everybody, Tom Merritt from the DTNS headquarters in Los Angeles and a very special DTNS Labs interview episode. First of our interview episode since we launched DTNS Labs, and I couldn't think of anyone better to kick it off than Andrew Allen, pianist, composer, arranger, musicianist extraordinaire. Is that even a word? I don't know. But Andrew Allen, welcome to the show.
Hey brother, how are you?
I'm good, man. Really excited to talk to you because if people aren't familiar, Andrew does great music. He does great geeky music. And you have crowdfunded a large portion of what you do.
Yeah, that is very true. I'm signed to Coverville Records with Brian Ibbett. And we've produced 5 albums over the past 6 years.
So tell folks a little bit about your music and what you do before we get into the nitty gritty of the Kickstarter aspect of it.
Sure. So I take popular culture music, things like Star Wars and Star Trek and video games, and I turn them into straight ahead jazz standards, similar to what you would listen to in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah. So that was one of the first things that brought you to my attention. I think it was probably Smooth Federation was the one that I first heard about, where you did an entire album of Star Trek jazz.
Yeah, I have so many fun stories about that record. So that was my first record with Brian Ibbett. And here's how it all happened. In 2011, I graduated from college with a jazz studies degree. So I was looking down the barrel at probably working at Starbucks.
Yeah.
I decided to start doing these jazz covers of Star Trek. And I was listening to The Morning Stream, which is a podcast with Scott Johnson and Brian Ibbett. And mm-hmm. They had this part of the show called Stump a Trek Nerd. I love that show, and I wanted to write some background music because I noticed that they didn't really have any. It was just this stock thing that Scott was playing. So I did the original series theme as a jazz piano trio, something that you would hear as bed music under something like that.
Right.
And then I sent it over to Brian, and then Daryl, the Trek nerd, reached out to me on Twitter and said, "Oh my gosh, we're going to use your music." And I was, you know, I just completely freaked out. So I got a lot of great emails from Brian, and I just kept sending them music. Every few weeks, I would just send them something new. And around November of 2011, Brian Ibbett emailed me and said, "Hey, why don't we do a record of all Star Trek songs, and we'll do it through Kickstarter." And this was right when Kickstarter was really starting to take off. And it's been history ever since.
Yeah. So how many albums have you done through crowdfunding, through Kickstarter?
Oh gosh. Well, we did Smooth Federation, Free Play, Marvel's Secret Identity, Star Wars. And our most recent one is Jazzness, which is a massive collection of NES themes, which was in conjunction with the NES launch that Nintendo did a couple years ago.
And I should disclose that Andrew was nice enough to let me use a little bit of the live from the Cantina jazz in my Pretend I'm Dumb About Star Wars series on YouTube, which was really fun. I love all your stuff because, I mean, the Cantina Band's probably the one that's most recognizable in your genre already, but a lot of times I'll be listening to stuff, or what's even more fun is to play stuff for folks, and they'll have no idea what it is. They're like, "Oh, what track is this? Who's this jazz musician?" And then it'll click what they're listening to. They're like, "Wait a minute, is that the Star Wars theme?"
Yeah, man, that's always been one of the fun things about my music. I was at Star Trek Las Vegas in the summer of 2012, and we had a lot of people buy the album, buy Smooth Federation, and I had someone come up to the booth and say, hey, I bought your CD yesterday. I got to tell you, I don't like jazz, but I really like your music.
And and what do you, how do you respond to that?
I tell them that maybe you do like jazz. It's just that you don't like what you hear on the mm-hmm. on the radio.
What you've been told is jazz, probably. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, with jazz, we're a little over 100 years old, and in that time, we've gone through 20 or 30 different iterations of the art form. So when you look at something like classical music, for example, they would go through different styles like Baroque and classical and Romantic, and those styles would last, you know, 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then it would slowly morph. But it just so happened that jazz, every 4 or 5 years, we would be changing the style and adventuring into new forms and new things. And I think that one of the reasons why is because with classical music, during that time, people lived and died within 20 miles of one another.
Mm-hmm.
So wherever you were born, you're probably going to die there too.
Yeah.
So music didn't really travel that far.
No, and if it traveled as sheet music anyway, and someone else had to learn to play it. You didn't see the musicians themselves, you know, doing a world tour. They didn't even know how much world there was to tour back then.
Absolutely, man. And with jazz, and the Creole of color in New Orleans, that's when travel started to pick up as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a lot of migration. I mean, you know, jazz and blues, particularly, I feel like, benefited from people from the automobile and people moving around and sharing what the music was like in their area with others.
Absolutely, and that's why, you know, whenever you listen to jazz, and even today, the sound that you hear from New York jazz musicians and California jazz musicians are completely different, and they almost have their own style based on their geographical location. It's really cool.
Well, that's what's really interesting to me is at a time when you can infinitely share music around the globe instantly, you can still have these regionalisms persist.
Absolutely, and you know, there's a bunch of people like me. I'm a tad bit of a traditionalist,
mm-hmm.
so I personally believe that cool jazz was not around as long as it should have been.
When you say cool jazz, what is that?
Sure. So that was a subgenre of jazz that was made popular in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And I might be off a couple years, but when Kind of Blue came out, which was Miles Davis's most famous record of all time, that was cool jazz. And I think even to this day, it's in the iTunes top 10 every year.
So bebop is part of cool jazz then?
Yeah. So bebop came before cool jazz. The story about bebop is that we had jazz dance bands leading up to bebop.
Mm-hmm.
Things like Cab Calloway and Duke Ellington's dance bands and Basie and all of the big bands. And with bebop, it was a study in virtuosity and how good the actual musician could be. So I think that there's a big transition that happened with bebop, where it started to become less about the audience and started to become more about the musicians on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't really recovered from that. And it's not that bebop is bad. I absolutely love bebop. But for a lot of my family and a lot of my friends who aren't avid jazz listeners, it's sometimes can be pretty difficult for them to listen.
Well, and I think that goes to the fact that a lot of people say they don't like jazz, but like your music, because they are thinking jazz is either Oscar Peterson or something really experimental, or something that plays in the elevator, right? It's some kind of easy listening sort of thing. And yours is neither of those.
Absolutely. So I think that, you know, with with being elevator music or being something on NPR that's really weird and really fast, that's kind of all that you're getting over the radio right now. And my whole goal, whenever I started to do these, was to introduce a brand new audience to jazz and to show them that there's more than just smooth jazz and modern jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I used to teach quite often, and I was working with a high school jazz combo, which is a small group that you would see in the late 30s and 40s and beyond now. So there's piano, bass, drums, guitar, and saxophone. And they were in the same kind of group of, well, I don't really like jazz. I don't like smooth jazz. I don't like modern stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I showed them music from the 40s and 50s, and they absolutely loved it. You know, and I think that it's just that we're not exposing enough people, especially in K-12 education. We're not exposing them enough to all types of jazz.
Yeah.
And that's why we're getting the bias.
So you're saying you've got no kick against modern jazz unless they try to play it too darn fast.
now see, here's the problem. I just finished up my master's, and that was also in jazz. I don't know what I was thinking.
Uh-huh. You love jazz. That's what I'm guessing.
Man, I totally dig it. And I can appreciate those things, but I also know that, you know, my wife who is really into pop music, you know, she can't be in the car with me for more than an hour if I'm playing modern jazz. She just hates it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So you've taken cool jazz, you've added Batman and X-Men and Han Solo to it, which is another great way of bringing people into it. But you're complicating it by saying, okay, and I need you to back me on Kickstarter to make it work. How do you make that appeal when you're like, okay, I know a lot of you think jazz is this, but I'm going to give you something really fun that I know you love. Give me money.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. You know, when Brian and I were trying to come up with how to do it, we decided, you know, each Kickstarter. So we've learned over 6 years now what works and what doesn't and what's more profitable than others. So we noticed with Smooth Federation, the thing that really helped us was having people involved that were doing artwork designs for us.
Mm-hmm.
So we had Scott Johnson do the album cover, and he's a phenomenal artist.
Yeah.
So you know, having little perks like that and selling album artwork, that really helped, because at that point no one knew who I was. You know, I was I was virtually unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, we've developed a fan base where we can offer things on Kickstarter, like extra songs, bonus content, bonus compositions, and sheet music. And we're starting to get a really good response from that.
So do you think that that's kind of the key to any enterprise like this, is to go out there and find someone to partner with that can give you a leg up and exposure? Is you know, if we were to generalize this to other people who have maybe art or books or something that they're wanting to crowdfund, is that one of the keys?
Absolutely. But I think the what people should think about doing is finding influential people who support your art. So don't just go to anybody and pay them to do something and pay them to promote, but actually find someone who likes what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. So don't go to one of those services that says, we'll boost your search engine optimization ranking and social media presence in 5 days. Or if you do, don't rely on that. Find somebody who cares about what you're doing. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. And I mean, I've used different SEO services over the past couple years. And what I've noticed is that I receive more traffic from my friends and frog panners who actually talk about liking my music than I ever have from SEO optimization.
Well, and one of the things I noticed, I noticed this when we had Sword and Laser on the Geek and Sundry Network, we got a lot more exposure. We had a lot more people sampling the show, but fewer people stuck around because they were only sampling it because they'd heard about it, not because they liked it. You know what I'm saying? And I think what you're talking about is an element of that where you're better marketing, quote unquote, to people who are likely to like what you do than taking more of a cannon shot approach.
Absolutely. And I think knowing your audience is a big part about your Kickstarter success. So I knew, you know, I was a big Frog Pants fan before I started submitting music to the Morning Stream. So I kind of knew what that market was and what they like.
How much of, and I don't need you to give me your P&L, you know, or let me into your accounting, but how much of your living is made doing this?
I'd say that my living is based on my compositional services that mm-hmm. I offer. That's primarily what my bread and butter is. And then the work that I do with Brian Ibbett is really pure art. We only really make enough to make the record and get the music out. And sure, mm-hmm. we might take a very small amount. But that's after everybody else is taken care of.
Yeah, sure. It's your calling card, so to speak.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, sometimes people get trapped in creating an art only for money. Mm-hmm. And I think the art form suffers when that happens. And you know, it is easy for someone to say that. But I truly believe that the Kickstarter projects are it's like a recording in history for me as a composer and a performer. Yeah. So I can look back on Smooth Federation and it's a snapshot of my skills. You know, sometimes it's really difficult as a jazz musician to listen back to something from 2001.
Tell me about it. It's hard as a podcaster to do the same thing.
Absolutely, man. There's a lot of stumbling and a lot of learning happening during that time. But I think that using the work with Kickstarter has helped me grow my other businesses in online music lessons and composition.
Well, and I think that's one of the things the internet empowers is this is kind of a model for a lot of us, which is we have a main thing that we love to do. That, you know, maybe it's break even, maybe it pays the bills, but doesn't, you know, match what a salary would be like at an office. But it leads you to other jobs that can then be done, again, remotely because of the internet for people that you would have never been able to get as clients. So, like you say, in the classical period, you either, you know, you had to find somebody to work for in your locality, and that was your option, or you had to move, which was really hard. Now, you can stay wherever you are, do a thing that you love, that then gets you other jobs that kind of help fill in the gaps.
Absolutely. I've been trying to tell my wife this for like 5 years now. I think you're absolutely right. And you know, the years of patronage and having churches pay for your music, and you know, over hundreds of years, the church kept classical music alive.
Yeah.
And you during even the jazz era, even the early 1900s, you had patrons in New York who would pay for musicians to live just so they could write music and perform. So I think that being online, I think it gives us a huge advantage because someone who's not from Florida, who, you know, who can be from a completely different state, can find my music and find my compositions. And if they're ever in need of compositions or anything else, they're able to hire me and I don't have to fly out there and they don't have to fly to me.
Yeah. And it's a model that I don't think we hear people talking about when they say, like, well, we need digital rights management to pay the musicians. We need Spotify rates to YouTube rates to go up to pay the musicians. And without getting into that whole morass, there are other ways. And yours is one I don't hear mentioned a lot, which is you make the money off of compositions, and the music that you put out publicly is meant for creativity, for your own satisfaction, for the enjoyment of people listening, and to kind of show what you can do.
Absolutely. I exclusively make my living from writing music, playing music, and teaching music. And I would be willing to say that 95% of that is online. And Kickstarter, I think for Kickstarter, it gives me an outlet to create albums, which in this day and age, you know, people are more, I feel as though people are more apt to receiving singles, and they're not clamoring as much for all of these album drops as they were in years past. Mm-hmm. And I think that with Kickstarter, a great promotional tool is posting your project on Kickstarter and then hoping that Kickstarter picks it up and makes it one of their projects that they love.
That they highlight.
Pick from that.
Yeah. Well, Andrew, this is fascinating. I could talk all day with you, and I'm a big fan of your music too. So thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Tom. And I really appreciate you guys, and I love all of the work that you do, and thank you for giving me the time.
Yeah, you bet. If people want to find out more about your music, where they can get the albums, your future Kickstarters, or commissioning you, where should they go?
Absolutely. They should go to andrewallenmusic.com. So Allen, A-L-L-E-N. If they go to andrewallenmusic.com, they can find links to all of the albums. And most of these albums you can stream on Spotify and Apple Music.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have my compositional services set up there and also Skype piano lessons.
Do we have anything in the works coming up soon to tell people about yet, or is it all still in the misty planning stages?
Well, it's funny you actually mentioned that. So I've been working on a solo album with no other instrumentalist, just me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a combination of modern piano and EDM.
Oh, wow.
It's super, super duper top secret.
Uh-huh.
It makes me nervous even talking about it because, you know, my wheelhouse is jazz.
Yeah.
So going over to EDM has been a big step for me because there's a lot of production elements and creation using wavetable synths and mixing techniques that you need to know to make quality EDM. And since I'm so much of an artist, I don't necessarily want to just send it out and have someone else do it for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I've been slowly learning all of these processes.
Wow.
What I've found interesting with EDM is that all of these songs are so like piano and all of the EDM elements are wrapped around that core piano chords and melody. So it's really interesting for me to be able to sit down, not have any sheets of music, not have anything to go off of, because up until this point, I've been doing piano arrangements of already made songs.
Right.
So I've had melodies to go off of. I've had chords to go off of. This is completely different. So my ritual is I'm sitting at the piano. I have Ableton open on my computer, and I am sitting there playing chords and playing forms of chords over and over again, and then just expanding from there.
Wow. Well, I that is a big gamble, but it sounds like it's a heck of a lot of fun for you, and I can't wait to find out what comes from it.
Awesome. Thank you so much, man. I can't wait to find out either.
Your secret is safe with us. We won't tell anyone until it's ready. AndrewAllenMusic.com again, folks, to find out more about what Andrew's doing. And thanks to everybody who supports us. You are the patrons that we were talking about. Patreon.com/DTNS. we'll leave you with a little Andrew Allen music. Talk to you soon.